Good morning. Please be seated. This is case number 70833, Tyco Funding Corporation versus Michael J. Mona et al. Before we get started, Justice Gibbons.
Again, for the record, for the parties, I did represent Mr. Bob on when I was in private practice attorney probably 20 to 30 years ago. I don't feel it's a disqualifying event in this case, but I want to advise the parties of that.
With that, if Counsel Tyco is ready to go, Tyco, rather.
I am here.
And if you wish to reserve any time?
I do. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bart Larson. I'm counsel for the appellant in this matter, Tyco Funding Corporation, who asks that this court reverse the district court's conclusion that the notice of default and notice of sale that Tyco sent to the borrowers and guarantors in this matter at the notice address discussed in the loan documents were insufficient simply because Tyco was aware of an alternative address for one of four borrowers, one of five guarantors. As we set forth in our briefing, there were a number of errors that allowed the district court to arrive at that conclusion. Before getting to that, however, I'd like to first address the false narrative being pushed by the respondents that the district court's decision was somehow based upon a finding of impropriety or wrongdoing or bad faith by Tyco. That's simply not the case. There was no finding by the district court that Tyco acted in bad faith. There was no finding that Tyco attempted to conceal the foreclosure of the trustee's sale from any party. In fact, Mr. Norman testified at trial that he did not believe that Tyco had intentionally attempted to conceal the foreclosure sale. So to the extent that it suggested that the district court's determination was based upon any such finding, that's simply incorrect. Now, moving on to the issue we've addressed in our briefs, I'd like to first address the substantive compliance arguments. And the starting point for that argument, Your Honors, is the purpose of NRS 107.095. We know from the Schleiner case that the purpose of that statute is to provide notice to guarantors that a loan is in default and that a foreclosure sells it. We also know from Schleiner that substantial compliance with that statute is acceptable. Restricted compliance does not occur. Now, in this case, we have a loan made by California lenders to a mix of California and Nevada borrowers guaranteed by California guarantors. The loan documents.
Well, can you tell us who the makers of the loan were and the guarantors? I'm a little confused on that. Who signed the note on that and who were the guarantors and how was this set up?
Okay, there were four borrowers under the note.
Okay.
AOE LLC, a Nevada limited liability company. The Norman Family Limited Partnership, a California partnership. Ali Morichahi, a California resident. And the Mona Family Trust, a Nevada trust.
They're the makers. Okay.
Makers of the note.
Okay, and the guarantors are?
The guarantors are Ali Morichahi again, Isaac Norman, Michael Mona, Rana Mona, and Hamid Mabah.
Okay.
And again, Mr. Morichahi, Mr. Norman, California residents, there's no success back.
Okay.
Now, in the guarantee, as well as in the deed of trust, they specified an address, in the Comstock address, as we called it, as the address to which notices must be sent to the borrowers and guarantors. That's not an address that's buried in some dense boilerplate language. It's on the signature page. It's something they undoubtedly would have seen when they signed the guarantee. This isn't the first time that Mr. Norman, in this case, the Norman Family Partnership, would use that Comstock address for notice purposes in connection with a real estate investment. In fact, we know of at least four or five other real estate investments that he has made jointly with Mr. Morichahi. And as was testified to a trial, at least one of those deals used that Comstock address as the notice address for the Norman Family Partnership and Mr. Norman as well. We know it was an accident in this case that address was used. Mr. Norman himself testified at trial at least seven times that Mr. Morichahi was designated as the key person, as he put it, or the primary point of contact for Tyco for this loan. That's why that address was used. We also know that Soelia Morichahi received at least one of the notices of default that was sent to that address by Chicago Title. In an email to Mr. Norman from September of 2013. She specifically told him that she had received a notice of sale from Chicago Title and Dayco. He responded, acknowledging it was a notice of sale from Chicago Title and Dayco. There's no dispute that that notice was received. Beyond that, we have the March 12, 2012 letter that Dayco sent to Mr. Norman advising him of the delinquency in payments and the imminent foreclosure. That was sent to an address on Wall Street, which is where some of the findings in the district court's decision come from. The fact that Dayco was aware of that address. But Mr. Norman himself testified that mail sent to that address in 2012 and 2013 was actually being forwarded by the Postal Service to a different address on Main Street.
So did you send any other notices of the trustee's sale to the other makers of the note and the guarantors prior to the trustee's sale?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The notice of default was sent by Chicago Title to all of the borrowers, all the guarantors, at the notice addresses specified in the loan documents. And it's undisputed that no borrower, no guarantor ever provided any change of address notice to Dayco. They never requested the notice be sent to any alternative address. And beyond that, we had the notice of sale, which was, of course, sent out according to loan documents as well. The district court's determination was based upon its finding that because Dayco was aware of its alternative address on Wall Street, possibly an address on Main Street, that the notices should have gone to that address. But that's not what the loan documents specify. That's not what the law required. Yeah, we had substantial compliance. Judge Scanlon, in an order granting summary judgment, or partial summary judgment in Dayco's favor, held that there was actual notice of not just the default, but also the coming foreclosure sale. And that actual notice, coupled with the fact that there was no real prejudice, as the district court found, there was no effort by any of the defendants to cure default. They didn't even try to cure the delinquent tax payments that occurred at that point in time, which were much less than the outstanding balance of the loan.
Well, is there proof that they were aware of the date of the trustee's sale and had the opportunity to bid and all at the sale?
They were sent the notice of the trustee's sale specifying the date of the sale at the notice address specified in the loan documents.
Well, a lot of times there's like negotiations and all that before the sale. I'm just saying, is there any other evidence in the record that they knew of the sale and they had an opportunity to be there and bid?
I don't think there's any evidence in the record that would indicate that Mr. Norman himself knew of the actual sale date before it occurred. But he undoubtedly knew there was a delinquency in payment in March of 2013, more than a year and a half before the foreclosure sale. He undoubtedly knew, as of September of 2013, a few months before the foreclosure sale, that a notice of sale had been issued by Chicago Title and Default and Dayco. And going back to prejudice, I'm sorry, I forgot where I was just a moment. But the district court held that there had been no attempt by any of the borrowers or guarantors to pay the delinquent taxes or the outstanding loan balance. Mr. Norman himself testified at trial that he had no intent of paying those delinquent taxes or the outstanding loan balance. They made no effort after learning that notice of sale in September of 2013 to contact Dayco, to contact Clark County, to contact Chicago Title, to find out anything more about the foreclosure sale. There was no finding of prejudice and there's no evidence to support such a finding. So based upon the fact that they had actual notice of the default and of any foreclosure sale, if not the actual date of the foreclosure sale, they knew what was coming undoubtedly. That is sufficient for substantial compliance. And I am aware of the court's dissent in the Schlein case, in which it held that failure of a lender to attempt to send notice to a guarantor did not comply with the statute. But in this case, Dayco actually did send that notice to the guarantor at the address specified in the loan documents. The guarantor's argument it should have been sent to another address based on its pre-existing business relationship that went back long before the loan. But that wasn't the notice address that was given at the time the loan was made. That wasn't the address to which Dayco was contractually required to send the notice. It sent the notice in accordance with the responsibilities of the loan documents. Another issue with the district court's decision is its determination of the violation of due process somehow. And in this case, we know from this court's decision in Saticoy Bay case earlier this year, that in instances where there is a non-judicial foreclosure of a property, it's unlikely that you have due process turn the concerns that would be addressed. And in order for there to be a due process issue, there has to be both a deprivation caused by an exercise of some right or remedy under state law, and the party charged with that deprivation has to be considered a state actor. Here in this case, we have a non-judicial foreclosure conducted by a private lender. That there is no state actor to support a finding of any sort of deprivation of due process in this case. Now, there are some clear mistakes the district court made as well in its interpretation of the relevant sections of Chapter 107. One of those key mistakes is the fact that the district court failed to distinguish between the Norman Family Partnership as a borrower and Mr. Norman himself as a guarantor, but discussed them jointly, referring to them only as the Normans. Under NRS 107.080, that notice of default and notice of sale are required to be sent only to the guarantor or trustor of the property, essentially the borrowers. The remedy, if a lender fails to do that, fails to serve adequate notice under that statute, is that the guarantor, or excuse me, the grantor or the trustor of the property can bring an action to rescind the foreclosure sale and also recover statutory damages and attorney's fees. There is no remedy in 107.080 that would allow that party to recover, excuse me, to be excused from their liability under the loan documents. With that, I will reserve the remaining amount of my time for about. Thank you.
On behalf of the other parties, a single argument or split on?
Just a single argument. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kathleen Wilde, and I work for Markey Arbach Coffin. Our firm represents the respondents in this matter. We respectfully submit that this Court should affirm the District Court's rulings because they're based in part on equity and also in large part on the facts of the District Court found during the bench trial. These are deferential type decisions, and we believe that that deference is owed in this case because those matters were supported by substantial evidence. Moreover, we respectfully submit that DACO has not met its burden of proving that there was actual error that warrants reversal. I'd like to start with the discussion of whether or not there was knowledge of the sale that was coming up. Is there anything that was in the record saying, could they come to the auction? Could they do something if they're interested in stopping the sale? And the answer is no. We know that the notices that were sent out from Chicago Title were returned, with the exception of one, undelivered. The reason for that, and this is something that really bothered Judge Gonzalez, is that DACO knew there were other, better addresses, and they purposefully withheld that information from Chicago Title. Chicago Title sends out notices based on the information before. So when it relied on the representations from DACO, Chicago Title naturally did not send anything to the addresses that were known because Mr. Deani, who is the agent and a principal for DACO, did not provide that information.
So the only notices that were sent out by mail, pursuant to 107.080 and SEC, were to this address where it was returned. The notices were returned. There
that
were no
correct.
Other notices sent out to any other addresses to either the makers or the guarantors.
That is correct, Your Honor. Everything had been sent to the Comstock address, and those things came back as undelivered. Another thing that's worth noting, too, is...
Well, let's come back on that. Since the verbiage required notices to be sent there as to all the individuals, but yet we have Norman who had another address, is that correct or?
That is correct. Dr. Norman actually had two other addresses that were known to DACO through his principal, both the Wall Street address and the Main Street address. And the way that those addresses were known, not just because of their prior attorney-client relationship, but also that's shown by the fact that they sent a letter to the correct address. They sent other communications to that address.
And does that failure implicate or impact the other parties who had not changed address?
Judge Gonzalez found that it had, and the reason for that is stated in her factual findings that there were other addresses, plural, that were known and that were not given to Chicago Title.
As to the other parties?
That is what Judge Gonzalez found. That is in her findings of fact.
I'm concerned because what I gleaned from the record was that the Norman or Norman parties were the parties who had been in conversation. So I wasn't aware that other parties had given other addresses.
I understand your concern on that, Your Honor, and it is an interesting and important distinction that it's, you know, not necessarily what's good for one is good for all.
And the other minor wrinkle is the fact that the guarantor stated that they had to go through a procedure to change mailing address, which obviously no one bothered to do.
That is correct. That wasn't the terms of the loan documents, that if they had to change an address, that would need to be done. I think the reason that Judge Gonzalez was so bothered by the situation in a lot of ways sounded in equity. She found it very disturbing that the address on Comstock was known to be a problematic address because Mr. Moran Shahi had already fled the country at that time. And she found that very problematic, that even though everyone knew this address was not going to result in actual notice, they continued to rely on it. I think that she found that really disturbing, that somebody who was serious about giving notice wouldn't include just an extra line or two when doing their affidavit, when doing that information for Chicago Title, which would have resulted in just a single, you know, extra envelope, a couple extra stamps to try to ensure that these parties got notice.
Well, the converse of that is, wouldn't the other parties who were potentially liable, if they were aware that their partner had left the country, be concerned also as to their lack of notice or notice?
One would think that, although that's not something that's really addressed in the record. The extent of what we know about knowledge is pertaining to what DACO knew about Mr. Morashanti. The only thing that we kind of know as far as communications is we do know that the Norman entities attempted to reach out to the Morashantis by sending an email. And the email is about property taxes. It's not even about this actual issue. And the confusion is shown in that email, where Mrs. Morashanti tries to respond in a meaningful way, but it's kind of, there are ships passing the night. They're not really addressing the same issue at the same time. So we know that there was an attempt, but based on that email, I don't know if it was clear to anyone where he was at. The only reason that we have a factual finding on that was because the district court, after hearing evidence at the bench trial, specifically found that it was known at least to the DACO and to DACO's agents that they knew because of their other business transactions with Moran Shahi. So I think that was why that was particularly disturbing to Judge Gonzalez. And in a lot of ways, that's what her decision reflects. She has concerns as a matter of equity. We recognize that saying due process is problematic now because of Satterfield, but that wasn't out at the time that this decision was made. But still, it comes down to a matter of equity, that when faced with all of this evidence and hearing the testimony before her during a bench trial, Judge Gonzalez did not see steps that were reasonably tailored to give somebody notice. There was no reasonable opportunity to go to the sale because, of course, the envelopes were kicked back, having been from the wrong address. There was also the concern, and it was at least mentioned in this court synopsis, that choice of law is an interesting issue here, too. Whenever we have a discussion on the guarantors, the question is, well, didn't they waive their right to notice anyway, at least because of the way that California law applies? There was some discussion in the reply that this is not even properly before the court, and that's false. We have a whole slew of sites which show this has been a point of discussion from the outset of this case. This was a topic of interest in the opposition to summary judgment in the trial brief. The opening argument before Judge Gonzalez mentioned this topic, and then in the motion to amend again, it was all a big discussion of choice of law. And the real concern was, can a party seeing something that says California law applies know that, well, that actually means I'm waiving my rights to receive notice when that party is not law-educated, doesn't have any, you know, particular understanding of what that would mean. And the other concern was, under the factors that apply to these types of choice of law analyses, not only was this something that was done to avoid the actual situs of this transaction, but is this something that Nevada law would even allow? And in doing this analysis, Judge Gonzalez really honed in on NRS 40-453. And this statute is remarkably clear in its language, saying that a court shall not enforce the type of waiver that existed here. So to the extent that the guarantors theoretically, you know, were waiving rights, that really is not something that's supported by the record. There was good reason for the district court's decision finding otherwise.
Don't we also, though, have a premise in the state of Nevada that the parties are allowed to freely enter into contracts unless they're repugnant to public policy?
That is correct, Your Honor. And we certainly do have a recognition that parties have a right to contract and that we try to honor the parties as much as possible. But by the same token, it is repugnant to public policy when the statute specifically says that our legislature is against people waiving these important rights to notice in documents such as this. So there is a tension there, but it's consistent with the purpose of the statute that we really don't want parties.
Well, I bring it up because as you bring the equity argument up, I'm a little concerned because one party had to know that recently in California law, if the guarantors were also the signers of the other note, you potentially had a sham transaction that's invalid.
That's definitely a concern, because from our understanding of California law, that would be a problem when you have a corporate entity that is securing a loan and that is basically the principals or the individuals for those corporate entities, partnership entities.
So straining to bring back all my law school knowledge of way back in the dark ages, we have unclean hands probably on both sides. What do I do with
that? Yeah, I'm only concerned about too, because you have makers. That's all I want to know, who's in what category, because if it's a revocable trust, as a maker, it's the same as an individual doing it. You know, if it's an irrevocable trust, it's different. So you have a merger here between the guarantor and the maker, you know, which is problematic
right.
as well. I don't know if that was, I'm just shooting off, but I don't know if all those issues were before Judge Gonzalez, then like that, and they factored it in a ruling.
And I think to get to Justice Douglas's point, if there are errors on both sides, if there are concerns on both sides, this court really should defer to the district court, because the district court held the bench trial, saw the testimony, had these determinations based on what she heard, had an idea of who was credible in their testimony, and made determinations of fact. And this court, of course, is not in a good position to address facts, only to assess whether they're supported by substantial evidence. The court also made decisions based on equity, which is, again, one of these areas that is really a highly deferential area. And also, an appellant has the burden of proving error. It's not a matter of proving irregularities. It's not a matter of proving this could have been better, this could have been more artfully done. It's a matter of proving, did the district court make an error that warrants either vacating or reversing? And so I think if we're in that scenario where we're kind of tossed up between, well, everybody could have done a better job here, that's not grounds for reversal.
So your position is the court's determination of whether proper notices received by the parties is an issue of fact, in that the court looked at these return notices and that was part of the court's conclusions then.
That is correct.
Of fact conclusions.
That is correct, Your Honor. And it's the same with the substantial compliance analysis. With substantial compliance, Judge Gonzalez made a finding that is subject to an abuse of discretion review. She determined that there was no substantial compliance. So in appellant's argument to the court, it was perhaps in a misstatement that there was no finding of fact, because Judge Gonzalez actually said the exact opposite.
Well, I think Schleining, as I recall, and it was a split decision of the court, the issue is it strict compliance or substantial compliance, and the majority said substantial, but the Judge Gonzalez says there was no substantial compliance. It's your position, so even under Schleining, that would support your argument.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the other point, too, that is important as far as substantial compliance goes, is that we have law stating that we're a party does not even make an actual attempt to comply with the statutes, which is effectively what Judge Gonzalez found based on the facts before her, that's not a scenario where we're talking about substantial compliance. And there also is the requirement, of course, of actual notice, which in this case, there may have been notice that payments had not been made, but that's a very different thing than having notice that there is a default, notice that there is a sale coming up. Those are very different things. So under that factor, even if we put aside what Judge Gonzalez ruled, which we shouldn't, but even if we were doing that on kind of heightened abuse of discretion type review, it still doesn't work in this case because there's not a reason to give substantial compliance under the particular facts and the equities of this case. So those issues are kind of, you know, the big questions before the court is really when we're looking at this case, it comes down to equity and it comes down to facts. Judge Gonzalez looked at the law, Judge Gonzalez applied the law, and although some of her ways of writing things were perhaps artful than we would have liked, at the end of the day, her determinations were made on facts and equity. And that's what we keep going back to. And unless the court has any other question, I don't know if there's any other particular topics that would be of interest. I know we've only touched on, say, 3 of the 10 issues that are before the court, but really that's what it's going to come down to, is that minor errors in findings of fact, minor misquoting of a statute, that's not the type of error that warrants reversal. And any type of confusion about the normas, for example, in their capacity as guarantor, in their capacity as borrowers, at most is harmless error. Because at the end of the day, Judge Gonzalez found that there was no reason for a deficiency judgment against either the guarantors or the borrowers. So if that was an error, it's minor and harmless at best.
Concern as to statutory damages at work life?
I don't know if that issue is even properly before the court. It's a kind of minor nuance, but there's a difference between a decision.
Was there a cross appeal filed on this?
this, upper drive doesn't matter.
There is not.
Let's think of something else.
Sure. Now, it's a difference between something that's reviewable and something that's appealable. The issue of damages comes up after the bench trial, after the findings of fact, conclusions, law, and judgment. It's an issue that comes up on a motion to amend, motion for reconsideration.
I'm specifically talking the propriety of the statutory damages, not the attorney's fees, not the cost. Mm-hmm. But is it appropriate pursuant to the law?
Pursuant to the law, the statute does support that because of the fact of who was holding title at the time that this thing was brought. We're in a backwards situation, admittedly, because of who brought a deficiency claim instead of having, say, a borrower come to court and say, this is wrong, set it aside. But Judge Gonzalez's interpretation of the statute wasn't as consistent with the facts here because of who held the property at the time. Does that answer your question, Aaron?
If it's your answer, it's your answer.
So in summation, we don't need to drone on and hear ourselves talk. Really, in summation, we submit that this court should affirm the district court's rulings because they're based on findings of fact that are supported by the record and supported by what happened during the bench trial. There are also great reasons in equity to uphold the district court's decision because there are facts throughout the record showing that what Dacre did was not consistent with someone who actually wanted to provide proper notice to a guarantor or to a borrower. And for those reasons, we respectfully submit that the court should affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, looking at this case from the big picture, if the district court's decision is affirmed, it essentially creates a situation where lenders cannot rely on notice, addresses specified in loan documents to conduct a foreclosure.
But the difference is that the notices came back returned. There was notice before the trustee's sale that this is a bad address and the people weren't getting notice. Am I wrong or is that what
happened? You are correct to an extent. There were notices that were returned to Chicago Title. Chicago Title did not tell Baker those would come back. There were other notices.
Chicago Title is your agent.
It was, yes. But there were other addresses that were, other notices that were delivered. We know at least one of them was accepted at the Comstock address because Suelia Morris-Shahi emailed Mr. Norman about it in September 2013. If you look at the trustee sale guarantee, you'll also see those notices were sent to several other addresses as well. Some of them may have been returned, but those notices were sent. And correct counsel statement, Chapter 107 doesn't require that the borrowers or guarantors have actual notice of the foreclosure sales. What it requires is that the statutory notices required be sent or that there's substantial compliance with those requirements, which there was in this case. Judge Gonzalez felt otherwise, but we did not feel that decision was supported.
But the standard review is, did she abuse her discretion?
Exactly, yes.
So how, and we have to give deference to her ruling on the factual part of it. How would you suggest, if we agreed with you, we write a decision on this point, since she made a factual finding that there was not substantial compliance?
One, that finding is not supported by evidence in the case. The great weight of the evidence showed that the Comstock address was a valid address. There was no finding that it wasn't a valid address. No borrower or guarantor had ever told Dayco to send notices to any other place. Under the loan documents, Dayco was contractually required to send notices to the Comstock address. Mr. Norman himself testified, as I said before, at least seven times during the trial, that was intentional because it was intended that Mr. Morichotti would take the lead on this project and be the primary point of contact with the lender. It wasn't an accident. The mere fact that Dayco knew of an alternative address does not give rise to some new obligation on Dayco's part to go out and send notices beyond what's required under the statute. And the district court clearly misread the statute. As I said before, under 107.080, there is no release from liability if there's a failure of notice to a borrower. The remedy is the borrower can sue to rescind the foreclosure sale and recover damages if the sale is rescinded. In this case, the sale wasn't rescinded, but the court awarded damages anyway. Beyond that, of course,
if it's sold at a trustee's sale to a bona fide purchaser, how can you rescind the sale? If somebody does it, some third party comes in and buys it and pays money for it, they can get title insurance and all that. I don't see how you can do a rescission under that situation.
It is specifically allowed under the statute under NRS 107.080. If the grantor, the borrower, the owner of the property, brings an action within 90 days of the foreclosure, that is a potential remedy to avoid that sale. Under 107.095, there is a potential for release to a guarantor that does not receive notice, but that statute does not authorize the court to release a borrower from liability if there's a failure of notice. And that release of liability only applies to the guarantor that did not receive notice. In this case, we only had one guarantor that argued he didn't receive adequate notice, and that was Mr. Norman. Yet the district court released not only all the other guarantors, but also the borrowers as well. That was a clear mistake under the statute. With regard to the addresses themselves, both the Wall Street and the Main Street address to which Mr. Norman claims notice should have been sent had been in use long before these loan documents were signed in 2005. He could have given either of those notice, either of those addresses to DACO for notice purposes in 2005 when the loan documents were signed. He didn't. And at no point afterward did he ask the notices to be sent to either of those addresses. It was always the Comstock address. There was no change of address, as the court noted. There was no determination by the district court that that Comstock address was not a valid address for notice. And from what I glean from the district court's decision, the district court simply concluded that for whatever reason, the Wall Street address was a better address for notice. But again, that does not comply with the statute. The suggestion that Mr. Morishadi had fled to Costa Rica, again, that's not accurate. Mr. Norman testified at trial that he was in contact with Mr. Morishadi in March and April 2012 when he received the first letter from DACO, that he remained in contact with him up through September of 2013 when we had the email exchange between Mr. Norman and Soleil Morishadi. Are there any questions, Your Honor? I'm happy to answer them, but if not, I only have 7 seconds left, so I'll leave it at that.
Justice Pickering, any good? Justice Pickering?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court thanks the parties for the arguments this day in terms of enlightening us as to questions we might have had as to the record and what was before us. With that, this matter will stand submitted. We are in recess until the next call of the court.